For our audience of blind and print-impaired readers, the North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program. It's the Indie Week, and I'm John Feddersen here to read it to you. And this issue, dated February 16th of 2024, will begin very shortly. And here we go first with Indy 2024 Primary Election Voter Guide. You've heard, those who listen to this program, have heard read Indy's recommendations for various offices. And here's a one-page insert in the voter guide because primary elections are underway right now, primary elections. And early voting is specifically, and the election day itself, Tuesday, March the 5th. And so this is a one-pager, and I'm just going to read the article, the little entries for each county and each office that are available for primary voters. First, Durham County Board of Commissioners. Voters elect five, and I guess they're guide, including recommendations, Nida Alam, Wendy Jacobs, Michael Lee, Stephen Valentine, Michelle Burton. Durham County, Durham Public Schools Board of Education, nonpartisan election. The previous one was partisan, but you elect at large. But this one is a nonpartisan. You elect one in District A, one in B, District 3, and at large. There are four recommendations. District A, Wendell Tabb. District B, Millicent Rogers. District 3, Jessica Carda Outen. And 4, the at-large bid, Joy Harrell. The only competitive state legislature primary this cycle, NC Senate District 22, and Mike Woodard is the recommendation. In Orange County, the Board of Commissioners, partisan primary, you elect one for District 2, and that recommendation, Phyllis Portal Ascott. For the Board of Education in Orange County, nonpartisan, you elect three at-large candidates, Carrie Doyle, Jennifer Moore, Wendy Padilla. Over in Wake County, the Board of Commissioners, partisan, and you elect candidates in District 5, Democratic, District 6, Republican, and we are not making endorsements in District 6. And Darren Eustens, who will appear on the ballot in that race, says he has suspended his campaign. And so their only recommendation for Democratic primary, which is partisan, is Tara Waters. And then the nonpartisan election for district court judges in Wake County, 10A, seat 3, 10C, seat 3, 10D, seat 5, and 10E, seat 3. There is no endorsement by the Indy Week for 10A. For 10C, recommended Renee Jordan. 10D, Kevin Boxberger. 10E, Crystal Grimes. And the Republican primary candidates for District 13, Indy does not make an endorsement. Candidates are Vicky Harry and Scott Lassiter. The Democratic primary for District 14, recommended Dan Blue. And the other Democratic primary, District 33, Monica Johnson Hostler. No endorsement for District 35 in the House, a Republican primary. And that concludes. There are the Indy Week will have the important dates. March 2nd ends early voting and primary election day. Again, it's the primaries. You need a registered voting site. You must provide accepted ID documents now. And this would include photo IDs. Don't forget them. And you'll, when you check in to vote, you'll be asked to show those photo IDs. All polling places are open now from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. on election day. You must vote in your assigned polling place, but the primaries is different. All right, that's it for that article. Now, before we move over to Durham for several articles, the first comes from North Carolina Newsline at NC State's Poe Hall, which is contaminated with PCBs. A breast cancer cluster is suspected there. Because of that, a 2020 study of nearly 800 North Carolina women found that PCBs might increase the risk of death from breast cancer, raising questions about a suspected cluster at Poe Hall, which is contaminated with high levels of this toxic chemical. In addition, among women who already have breast cancer, the study found PCBs could contribute to deaths from all causes. And PCBs are known to accumulate in breast tissues. Sampling results from Poe in November showed extremely high levels in multiple rooms and in air handling systems, reported NC Newsline. The university closed that building that month and relocated classrooms and offices where 100 to 250 people worked. Meanwhile, university officials were asking the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to conduct a health hazard evaluation regarding a breast cancer cluster there, according to documents obtained by Newsline under the Freedom of Information Act. Also in communication with CDC were Assistant General Counsel Leslie Mize, Head of Occupational Medicine, Maria Lehman, Director of Environmental Health and Safety, Robert Segura, and Senior Industrial Hygienist Ogaga Tebehevu. However, last month, progress on the evaluation stopped per NC State's request, WRAL reported, quoting the CDC. And university officials told the station the CDC is responsible for halting it. State has also tapped its outside lawyer to help the university navigate potential liabilities related to PCB contamination. Todd Ressler, a partner with Kilpatrick, Townsend, and Raleigh, was copied on several emails and invited to join a video conference about the evaluation. Ressler's expertise is in environmental litigation and regulatory counseling. Next, what are PCBs? Monsanto was the primary manufacturer of those in the United States. There are 209 PCB mixtures, commercially known as Aerochlores. In Poe Hall, Aerochlores 1254 and 1262 were detected, the test results showed. Those last two digits indicate the percentage of chlorine by weight. For example, Aerochlore 1254 is 54% chlorine by weight. Until the mid to late 70s, PCBs were commonly used in building materials such as caulking and carpets, flame retardants, fluorescent lighting, and electrical systems. The EPA banned their manufacture in 1979, but old buildings, such as Poe Hall, can still contain PCBs. They don't easily break down in the environment and are present in dozens of Superfund sites. These PCBs are still found in fish. State health officials have issued fish consumption advisories for PCBs throughout the state, including Lake Crabtree in Raleigh. How could you be exposed? Eating fish or other foods that contain them is one way, but so is inhaling or touching contaminated materials. How can they harm health? In addition to being a probable carcinogen, PCBs can also harm the immune, reproductive, respiratory, and nervous systems, cause skin lesions, and have been associated with diabetes and liver toxicity. What about the breast cancer study? Scientists at several universities, including UNC Chapel Hill, enrolled 456 white and 292 black women in North Carolina who were diagnosed with invasive breast cancer between 1993 to 96. Over a median follow-up of 20.6 years, there were 392 deaths, 200 of them from breast cancer. Here are the major findings of this study. Women with the highest blood levels of certain types of PCBs were at greater risk of dying of breast cancer within 5 years. And among women with breast cancer who lived longer than 5 years, higher blood levels of individual types of PCBs were associated with higher death rates from all causes. The total amount of PCBs in the women's blood also increased their risk of death from all causes from 20% to 37%. Several types of PCBs posed the greatest risk for breast cancer. These types are the individual PCB compounds, also known as congeners. Combinations of these individual compounds or congeners made up the mixtures used in the various aerochlores I mentioned earlier. Some aerochlores contain more than 90 congeners. To use a cooking example, if an aerochlore 1254 were a chocolate chip cookie, the congeners would be the chips, the butter, eggs, sugar, etc. If aerochlore 1260 were an oatmeal raisin cookie, the congeners would be different, oatmeal, raisins, cinnamons, etc. I believe they're not accusing chocolate chips, just as this is a metaphor or simile or whatever that is. The congeners associated with these higher death rates within 5 years were PCBs number 74, 99, and 118, the study found. Two other types, 183 and 187, also increased the risk of developing breast cancer. By race, PCB 74 was associated with a greater increase in breast cancer deaths among black women. A review of scientific literature showed that all of the PCB types found in the women with breast cancer are present in some formulations of aerochlore 1254 and 1262, both found in Poe Hall. However, the amounts in the aerochlore can vary, even by batch. This article, available in IndieWeek, includes quite a few links, which I can't relate to you here, but if you went to IndieWeek.com and looked at this article, you would be able to follow these links and see more detailed associations that come from the article. That's the best we can do here at NCReadingService.com. But I'm not through talking about health risks of environmental issues. Durham is closing off 35 additional areas of 5 city parks after the EPA has strengthened its lead screening levels. 35 additional areas of Walltown, East End, East Durham, Northgate, and Lyons Park today were fenced off based on new guidance. Portions of these parks are contaminated with lead, the legacy of municipal incinerators that operated or whose waste was disposed of there until the early 1950s. 4 of the 5 affected parts are in historically black neighborhoods. The previous EPA threshold for lead in residential play areas like parks was 400 parts per million. It's now 200 parts per million. DEQ spokesperson told Newsline that the new screening levels will apply to contaminated areas of Durham parks. Based on that new guidance, Durham officials will prohibit access to areas that previously screened between 2 and 400 parts per million, according to the city's webpage devoted to that issue. Quote, additionally, we are exploring options to install improved fencing and improved signage in these areas. Neighbors of Walltown Park recently photographed crumpled orange snow fencing lying on the ground near the basketball courts, one of the contaminated areas. Lead, if you didn't know, it's a neurotoxin. Chronic exposure can cause permanent neurological and brain damage in children who are especially vulnerable because they spend time outdoors and they often put their hands in their mouths. Adults with high blood levels of lead can suffer from brain, kidney, heart, and reproductive disorders. This list given below shows the number of locations that are off limits. And then there's a map on IndyWeek.com which shows the newly cordoned off areas, and I'll just read them. Walltown Park on Guest Road, 15 places. Lion Park, West Lakewood Avenue, 6 places. East End, North Alston, 4 places. East Durham, 2500 East Main, 3 places. At Northgate Park on Club Boulevard, 7 places in the East Central areas. And now the NC Department of Environmental Quality has ranked each park based on risk assessment that accounts for schools, churches, residents, drinking water wells within 1,000 feet of the contamination or on the site itself. The risk assessment occurred after DEQ accepted the parks into its pre-regulatory landfill program, which governs these dumps built before 1983 when they were then required to be lined to protect groundwater. In this program total, there are 700 sites. The highest risk score in the program is 526, the lowest 0. The top 50 sites in the program score at least 215. The top 100 sites score 156 or higher. These are the risk scores per park. Lion, 274. East End, 173. Walltown, 173. East Durham, 83. Northgate, 83. The scores do not necessarily reflect the amount of lead or hazardous materials in the park. However, these scores do help DEQ set priorities for cleanup based on proximity to people, drinking water, and surface water like rivers, creeks, and streams. For example, Ellerbee Creek runs through Walltown Park. NCDEQ surveyed each park's entire footprint through quarter-acre grids and examined the top 12 inches of soil. These samples are currently being analyzed, and a report is being prepared by DEQ with an estimated completion date before April of this year, said the city, at which point the results will be publicly released. It will then be used by staff to create a draft report containing options for remediation solutions. The report will be made available for public comment and community collaboration before approval and implementation. DEQ staff have agreed to participate directly in engagement activities at this point in the process. Durham Parks and Rec has submitted a request to assist with solutions for these parks as part of the city's fiscal year 24-25 budget process. Additionally, the staff has begun some deliberations with Mid-Atlantic on the topic of funding for remediation. And parenthetically, I apologize for that last little reference to Mid-Atlantic in the article that I'm reading. There's no mention of what Mid-Atlantic exactly is, and I cannot help any further with that. Continuing now, though, from Durham, DPS, public school workers, will keep higher pay rates for now. They will continue to receive raised pay rates through the end of this month. Thursday's unanimous decision from the Public Schools Board of Ed, which affects paychecks for classified staff, came just minutes after the district announced that all schools are closed Friday due to this transportation staff shortages. And also on Thursday, this is an article I believe parts of I might have read last week. Kati Quiroz Moore, interim superintendent. Former Superintendent Pascal Mubenga resigned the day prior. He stepped down amidst the fallout from this accounting error that caused these pay raises, which were not accounted for in the district budget, to be revoked for 1,300 classified staff in mid-January. This is, I'm recalling now, an article that I read pretty much in its entirety, along with some background information. So this is not a long-term solution to those wages, which initially had been told the employees they would have to return. So I will just pass on to the next article for now. As lights, this is about Durham advocates, residents, and officials elected gathering for Transit Equity Week. As the lights dimmed inside the Durham bus station last Wednesday evening, Congresswoman Valerie Fouché came into focus on the projector screen to share a message with a room full of transit experts, elected officials, and residents. She said Transit Equity Day takes place on Rosa Parks' birthday, February 4th, to honor her life, protest, and her pivotal role in the fight for transit equity. Fouché recently introduced legislation into the United States House to officially recognize Transit Equity Day. Quote, while her courageous action sparked a movement for transit equity, we are still far from achieving a truly equitable transit system. These members and officials gathered for Transit Equity Week and learned more about the future of Durham's transportation system. Bike Durham, a local equity nonprofit, led that event in collaboration with the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, Durham Congregations in Action, DCIA, People's Alliance, and the Coalition for Affordable Housing and Transit. Staff members from the City of Durham, Durham County, and GO Triangle presented updates to their combined transit plan, followed by a brief Q&A with state and local officials. Gregory Williams, campaign advocacy organizer at Bike Durham, shared anecdotes from community members that Bike Durham surveyed to highlight the ways folks engage with the transportation system in Durham and how fare free bus service, which GO Durham first implemented in 2020 during the pandemic, has impacted riders. Williams said fare-free bus service allowed residents to easily visit family members in need, access vital health care centers like Duke Regional and the Veterans Affairs Hospital, and connect youth with their friends as well as recreational opportunities. Williams said this underscores the interconnectedness and importance of a robust, accessible transit system that reaches beyond our immediate view. Chris Perlstein recently moved from Raleigh to Durham and shared his experience with a bus service. Perlstein reiterated the need for a holistic approach to transit. Quote, one thing that I would love to address with our elected officials is not just the buses themselves, but the tangential infrastructure, things like sidewalks and crosswalks that are missing throughout Durham. I live downtown where things aren't too bad, but every time I go north of 85 or south of 147, the whole picture changes, and I frequently run into a lot of challenges with the buses. Since that light rail project failed, Durham and neighboring communities have been searching for alternative paths to improve regional transit. Ellen Beckman, Durham County Transport Director, said community feedback consistently prioritized making improvements to the current system before investing in larger projects. So the four areas of emphasis highlighted in the county plan include improving the current system, connecting Durham to the region with options like bus rapid transit, improving all stops and stations, and completing projects more quickly. Then Jennifer Green, Mobility Services Planning Manager for City of Durham Transport Department, also presented the city's vision for the transit plan. Green said the city used COVID-19 funds to offer fare-free service the last 3 years, but, quote, the money is not going to last forever. City Council and staff have already begun the budget process for the upcoming fiscal year and are looking for ways to balance the budget while continuing to offer fare-free service, said Green. In 2022, Durham transportation staff conducted an onboard survey to get a snapshot of who was riding the bus by capturing different demographic information. 77% of riders identify as Black, according to the survey, while 87% of riders live within households making less than $35,000, and 77% of riders don't have access to a car. Green said, what this tells us is that anything we can do to improve bus stops, provide service more hours, improve frequency. It'll make that service more accessible, available, and make the experience with people riding with us a lot better. Other improvements included in the proposed transit plan are more direct routes between major stops that don't have to transfer at the main station, smaller transit hubs at the village, shopping center, and other areas with high ridership, and prioritized bus routes on Fayetteville Street and Holloway Street. After the presentations, Durham committee members Stella Adams led a Q&A with State Senators Natalie Murdoch and Mike Woodard, and County Commissioner Wendy Jacobs. They took questions from the audience about how they will support the transit plan through their different leadership positions. Murdoch, who serves on the State Senate Transportation Committee, along with Woodard, said, "Making improvements at the state level is an uphill fight." Quote, "We are in the supermajority, we are in the super minority of the minority of people that even care about transit, that even want you to have access to transit. It's not like that in other states. The state should provide more money, a lot more. Your tax dollars should go toward more sidewalks and more access to transit. But unfortunately, a lot of my colleagues think, oh, that's something for poor people, so they don't care about it. Those people didn't vote for me. So we have to fight tooth and nail to provide more access to transit." Now, last Thursday, there was a city council work session, and this is an article about the Durham mayor and civility amid tensions over Gaza. The room was packed at Thursday afternoon's city council work session. A masked woman held a sign reading, "Gaza must live," in green letters. A man wore a cape-like flag draped over his back that depicted the American and Israeli flags merging into one another. Another woman sported a chain necklace with a dog tag that read "Peace," followed by Hebrew letters. About 30 minutes into the meeting, the session reached item 46, quote, "Resolution supporting an end to the violence between Israel and Palestine." This wasn't the first time the council was hearing from Durhamites on that issue. Last Monday, a group of protesters entered the city council meeting to demand a ceasefire in the region. The scene was belligerent. One woman stole an Israeli flag from another woman and, quote, "dragged her across the floor," according to WRAL News. The resolution proposed by new city council member Chelsea Cook calls for the Biden administration to, quote, facilitate de-escalation and a sustained bilateral ceasefire, unquote, between Israel and Palestine. It also calls for the release of the hostages still held in Gaza and Palestinian hostages in Israel alike. It concludes by specifying that Durham, quote, supports all of its Palestinian, Israeli, Muslim, and Jewish residents and condemns anti-Semitic, anti-Palestinian, anti-Israeli, and Islamophobic rhetoric and attacks. The council members talked quietly amongst themselves, occasionally covering their microphones with their hands, about how to proceed with the sheer number of citizens who had signed up to speak. More than 50 attendees murmured and whispered amongst themselves. Mayor Leonardo Williams cracked a joke about the council discussing their vacations during the break, alleviating the tension for a moment. One by one, Williams denounced the name of the 8 people there to speak up via Zoom. Then he called on those 29 who were there in person, bringing them up to the microphone in groups of 5 at a time. Each Durhamite had 90 seconds to speak, and Williams would abide strictly by his timer. Layla Champion, speaking over Zoom, wanted an even stronger resolution that specified a, quote, permanent ceasefire. "They are not perfect victims," said Champion about the Gaza citizens, "nor should we expect them to be in the face of countless acts of violence and genocide," unquote, in response. An audience member exclaimed, "Yes." Others thought it was not Durham's job to take a stance on global issue, or the more pressing matter was the anti-Semitism facing Durham residents. Amy Rosenthal said Hamas is not only a terrorist organization, but it is known for breaking ceasefires. She also spoke about the local scene, saying, Durham is known as a hotbed of anti-Semitism. She received an uproar of negative shouts and hisses from the audience, and Williams banged his gavel multiple times, saying, I have no idea what the hissing is, sounding a bit like a disappointed parent, authoritative but caring. We are not going to be rude and disrespectful. We just cannot. There was resounding applause from the audience. Now, he added, if we're going to do this the Durham way, we're going to do it the Durham way, but we will have respect for one another. He continued, his brows furrowed, voice sounding stern and passionate. I see humans in here. I don't see snakes or anything. The hissing cannot happen. The interruption cannot happen. He allocated Rosenthal an additional 30 seconds, and the audience was silent thereafter. More speakers followed. Eli DeWitt, a student rabbi who approached the podium wearing a white yarmulke, called for a ceasefire. I am actually here to speak from a place of moral clarity that needs no religious justification. After all, 37 community speakers finished, Mayor Williams summarized the delicacy of these conversations and their importance in Durham, saying, the bigger picture from where I'm sitting is when I look out in the audience, I see people who have very different perspectives sitting amongst one another. The resolution itself was on the agenda at Monday's City Council meeting. And connecting by a few years from this meeting in Durham, a new documentary tells the story of a Chapel Hill hate crime. And the documentary itself is titled 36 Seconds, which is being shown around the area. It showed in Durham on February 12th and February 13th at the Carey Theater, and Monday, February 19th, the next opportunity to see it at the Student Center, Witherspoon Student Center in Raleigh. On February 10th, 2015, Chapel Hill resident Craig Hicks knocked on a condominium door belonging to his neighbors, Dia Shadi Barakat and Yusor Mohammed Abu Salha, who were eating an early dinner with Yusor's sister, Razan Mohammed Abu Salha. Using a .357 caliber gun, Hicks opened fire, killing Barakat with a spray of bullets and murdering the sisters execution style. For months, Hicks had been harassing the three students. Barakat was the dentistry school at UNC Chapel Hill. Yusor 21 was a prospective dental school student at NC State, and Razan, a North Carolina State University undergrad, who were all observant Muslims. Soon after the crime occurred, Chapel Hill police issued a statement declaring the triple homicide the result of a parking lot dispute. This massacre and the fight to charge Hicks with felony hate crime is the subject of a wrenching new documentary, 36 Seconds, Portrait of a Hate Crime, from director Tarek Al-Baba and executive producers Sean Dash and Omar Atalib. And it says the documentary will screen three times this month. There will be, and the February 12th screening included a panel discussion with Durham County Board of Commissioners Nida Alam and Durham District Attorney Satana DeBerry. Al-Baba, who is Palestinian-American and grew up in Charlotte, worked on 36 Seconds for 8 years. It was a big project. One of its more haunting aspects being how much archival material Al-Baba had to work with. In abundant photos and videos, it's evident how beloved the three victims were, how happily normal the lives they'd built were, brimming with basketball and sweet tea, purpose and success. Dia and Yusor were newlyweds, and joyful footage from their December wedding was still fresh when the massacre took place. Usor, in fact, had recorded a StoryCorps interview just months before. Quote, growing up in America has been such a blessing, and although in some ways I do stand out, like the hijab I wear on my head, there are still so many ways I feel so embedded in the fabric that is, you know, our culture. That's the beautiful thing here, she concluded. It doesn't matter where you come from. During a year when xenophobia, Islamophobia, and racism are spiking, 36 Seconds is particularly illuminating when contextualized in the language of the present moment. In reports about the genocide in Gaza, the media often employs passive doublespeak. They describe Palestinians who are killed as having died, for instance, while Israeli attacks are explosions, as if massacres are wrung from thin air. Alibaba tells Indy, right now it doesn't feel like we qualify as human. We're seeing insane hate crime violence. I mean, a six-year-old stabbed to death, three Palestinian students being shot at point-blank range. I hoped it would get better. I was idealistic. You look at that crime in 2015 and you see these patterns and you see how it intersects with the parallel of the election cycle. And we have a tumultuous election cycle ahead of us. We're seeing that spike in hate crimes again as Arab Americans, and that feeling post 9/11. At the time of the massacre, Craig Hicks, an unemployed former auto parts salesman, had a reputation for expressing both neighborly antagonism and a passionate anti-religious stance. The victims had tried to appease Hicks in the preceding months, and the night of the murder, when Hicks staked them out, walking into his apartment to get his gun, maneuvering through the gate, knocking on their door. Their cars were parked in the condominium-approved spots. Nevertheless, when Hicks turned himself in that night, footage of Hicks speaking cozily with police during those hours is particularly chilling. A parking lot dispute is the explanation he offered police. They accepted it, and that narrative took root. The local tragedy immediately made waves. Vigils held around the globe. President Obama issued a statement, quote, no one in the United States should ever be targeted because of who they are, what they look like, or how they worship. New Yorker writer Margaret Talbot reported a long-form story on it, and prominent figures like comedian Hasan Minhaj raised awareness. Both Talbot and Minhaj participate in this documentary. And the Barakat and Abu Salha families, in particular Dia's older sister, Suzanne Barakat, who also features prominently in the documentary, doggedly and with great dignity pursued justice, speaking up for the memory of Dia, Usor, and Razan. Alibaba says, speaking to the difficulties of securing a hate crime charge, particularly in North Carolina, where hate crime laws are particularly weak and are only classified as a misdemeanor, we need to be honest about what happened. How are you ever going to wrap your hands around a problem if you don't know it exists? It needs to be on record. In the end, Hicks was sentenced to life in prison, and the U.S. Department of Justice decided not to pursue felony hate crime charges, with local U.S. Attorney Ripley Rand stating, quote, there is no additional punishment Hicks could have gotten that would have meant anything. Of course, though, that's a version of justice that puts Hicks at the center. To the families of the victims, a hate crime charge would have meant a great deal. Even years later, the initial debasing explanation, hastily slapped onto a triple homicide, has left a mark. The culturally atomized word dispute, forming an impression, faint but just distinct enough, of petty mutual responsibility. A dispute takes place between two aggrieved parties. A hate crime is systemic. It indicts a perpetrator and implicates the culture that shaped that perpetrator. It's only becoming clearer that this culture has thrown its weight behind that hateful shape. Let's give a little nod to music now, and a little article about the Chamber Orchestra of the Triangle brings the magic of music to local school children. It's a little before the busy rush of lunch at Southwest Elementary School in Durham, but when the familiar strains of the Harry Potter theme float quietly over a chattering crowd of third graders, a magical hush falls over the assembly. All of a sudden, a sterile school gym is transformed into a luxurious music hall. The echoing chords of the cello create a sense of highbrow culture, like you're sitting in a velvet-draped box. But, of course, just by being here, the four musicians at the front of the gym are showing 8- and 9-year-olds that anyone can enter the enchanting world of music. The violinist Jose Oleovico says, "The school visits really pulled me in because that was something that helped me explore music when I was a kid. It's always super rewarding when you see sparkles in their eyes when they recognize Harry Potter or Star Wars." Vico is one of four fellows who was hired this year by the Chamber Orchestra of the Triangle, COT. He's a Durham local, but the other fellows come from various professional gigs across North and South America, from Chicago to Venezuela. The fellowship, which started in early September, is designed to support the careers of young Black and Latinx musicians, as well as connect local school children with orchestral music. Niccolo Muti, principal conductor and executive director of COT, said, "There was this huge need for live music in schools, and considering the diversity of the region, both racially and ethnically, we knew that whatever we wanted to do, we wanted to address that. If you look at American orchestras in general, there is a huge underrepresentation of minorities. Just the presence of the Durham Fellows in schools can show students that a career in classical music is possible from all walks of life and all cultures and ethnicities," says Muti, "and some of those kids might have a cousin or brother or sister who is around the age of the fellows, so it makes it much more personal and real for them." Vico, along with the violinist Timothy Parham, viola player Julius Adams, and the cellist Bedith Briceno, have been visiting schools in Orange and Durham County regularly throughout the year. Their January visit to Southwest Elementary was their second, and students eagerly welcomed them back by shouting out the names of instruments and the meaning of some musical terms. To the students at participating schools, forte means waving their hands around like crazy, making loud but silent movements. Likewise, piano is a subdued, curled-up motion they do when the volume of the music drops to a whisper. The interactive performance helps students remember and understand musical concepts, says music teacher Marcus Barnes, saying, "It creates an extension of what we learn in our classroom. A lot of times we're able to talk about string instruments, but not actually have them in front of the kids to experience them." For their part, thanks to the fellows, when students sit in the Carolina Theater's expansive concert hall, they will recognize Strauss and the way it tells a story. Viola player Adams explained to the students earlier this month, "This is the big part of our quartet, where our characters get into a fight. At the top of the page it says climax. That's where we are in the music. When we play, I want you to draw what you think your characters are doing. And when you come to see us at Carolina Theater in March, I want you to remember how music could inspire your imagination." I was unable to read this story when it's a corresponding appearance by the Justin Morris was at January 27th. However, it's Sluice. Justin Morris. When he was a kid, Justin Morris would leave home in Winston-Salem each summer for a family trip to Virginia. He says, on the old back roads, we'd pass a historical marker, and the marker was for Slink Shoal Sluice, he recalls. Every summer, without a clue what it meant, he'd think, that's the craziest combination of words. A sluice, Morris would soon learn, is a channel for controlling the flow of water. So captivating was the awkward, alliterative music of the historical marker that sluice, capital S, became the name of Morris's songwriting project in 2019. An obsession with water infrastructure abides. Radial Gate, his album released back in 2023, takes its title from an apparatus used in the spillways of dams. According to the cosmology of Justin Morris, everything is water. Listen to any song on Radial Gate and you'll hear it. Quote, I jumped the bank, a lanky otter, he sings on 4th of July. I'm looking at water hitting water. Even when he's not singing about rivers, his songs follow their fluid logic. Each gentle word floats like a raft downstream, meandering through scenes that form little eddies in the flow of narrative time. Morris through composes his songs, foregoing verses and choruses. The result is a discography that feels like a collection of short stories, though Morris rarely fictionalizes. When he turns his writerly attention on a spot where the, quote, river bends to a pool, on the song Mill, for example, you get the sense that he has a particular curve in mind, because he does. It's next to Okinichi Mountain. He tells me, if I'm trying to write something that's true, quote-unquote true, whatever that means, just talking about my experiences and where they happened is a route, for me, of getting close to achieving that. Morris's songs, rich with memory and close observation, are rooted in North Carolina's landscape and particularly in the semi-rural environs west of Durham, where he lives. Once, Morris says, he was wading in the Eno River with his bandmate Oliver Child Lenning and Child Lenning's partner when lightning struck the water. As it happened, they were all singing the Bill Callahan song, Drinking at the Dam. The story, too perfect to be made up, eventually became 4th of July. I am a cartoon Callahan, Morris sings on the track, playfully acknowledging one of his most important influences, I am the man getting struck by lightning. On a sunny January afternoon, I met Morris, tall, genial, a hugger rather than a handshaker, at the rental property he shares with Child Lanning. The two had just finished a series of 12-hour recording sessions for this new Sluice record. Alongside drummer Avery Sullivan and a few other collaborators, and they were recuperating outside with coffee and archery. Standing on a grassy slope below a makeshift stage, Morris slotted an arrow into his recurve bow, drew back the string, and let go. Child Lanning and his friend Walt sit in lawn chairs behind Morris. To their right was a goat pen with three residents, Pretty Sorrow, Tupelo, and Flora. Until recently, Morris and Child Lanning built things for a living. The goat pen was their handiwork. But a few months ago, following the success of Radial Gate, getting positive reviews from Pitchfork and The Guardian, put it on a Best of 2023 list, both quit their day jobs. This month, Sluice set out on their first headlining tour. Morris said, now sitting beside Child Lanning, we're both figuring out what being a quote-unquote full-time musician would be like. From the vantage of our lawn chairs, with the afternoon sun and the meadow grass, being a full-time musician didn't look so bad. Archery, fresh air, a few goats. That's like sitting at the beach, Walt quipped. The whole thing has not all been a beach for Morris, though when he was younger, he imagined a future for himself as a working musician. He studied music technology at UNC Asheville, where he met future collaborator Ali Rogers, who performs as Ali Blois, an engineered Radial Gate, and the members of the group Wednesday. But by his mid-20s, Morris was explicitly in a state of despair about music. When he released that first album as Sluice in 2019, he defiantly posted it online with no promotion. Art for art's sake. Radio Gates' positive reception has been incredibly validating, he says, especially among fellow musicians in North Carolina's lively scene, of which he has become an integral part. When he's not performing as Sluice, Morris plays in the Durham band Fust, and in Weirs, his and Child Lanning's experimental folk duo. He explains, a rich community is something I've been wanting for a long time, and I feel like it exists, which I'm incredibly grateful for. And I will curtail the remains of this article, three or four paragraphs left, Justin Morris, but you can find that article in its entirety with some links at indieweek.com. This article is a brief incoming. It's called Road Trip Capers, German Parables, and Bob Marley. And it begins with the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan, are now making their films separately. Would the movies still be good? Half as good. The happy news, Joel's 2021 film, The Tragedy of Macbeth, was a massive critical success, and now comes Drive Away Dolls, the first narrative feature film from brother Ethan. Billed as a queer road trip movie, Dolls stars Margaret Qualley as Jamie, a free spirit, who decides to recover from her most recent breakup with a trip to Tallahassee, as one does. Things get weird when Jamie and her bestie Marion, played by Geraldine Viswanathan, tangle with some wildly incompetent criminals. Several clues suggest that Dolls will be a good time at the movie. The story is based on a screenplay that Ethan wrote 20 years ago with longtime partner Tricia Cook, who was an editor on many of the brothers' best movies. Ethan described the new film as filthy fun, in the spirit of previous Coen comedies like Big Lebowski and Raising Arizona. The supporting cast includes Beanie Feldstein, Coleman Domingo, Pedro Pascal, and Matt Damon. And the first official trailer online now is fantastic. For a calmer movie night out option, the German drama The Teacher's Lounge is finally making it to local theaters. A big deal last year in Europe, it's up for an Oscar this year in international feature film category. The reviews on this one have been intriguing. The plot doesn't sound like much at first blush. An idealistic sixth grade teacher tries to solve a string of thefts at her school. But the script also operates on an allegorical level to explore themes of ethics, racism, indoctrination, misinformation, and our brave new world of relentless digital surveillance. It's the classroom as a microcosm, a societal parable dressed up as a psychological mystery. For dramatic renewal of purpose, though, you might want to make a date for Bob Marley, One Love, a new musical biopic based on the life of the reggae legend. The film is framed around the creation of Marley's 1977 Exodus album, but also doubles back to his upbringing in Jamaica and rise to international stardom. British actor Kingsley Ben-Adir has the title role, and Bob's son, Ziggy Marley, is on board as producer. The director, Rinaldo Marcus Green, who made a great film in 2019 about Venus and Serena Williams, with their dad, with King Richard. And finally, quick picks. Historical epic The Promised Land stars perpetually intense Mads Mikkelsen as a homesteader fighting corrupt 18th century Danish plutocrats. Everybody hates corrupt 18th century Danish plutocrats. Superstar screenwriter Diablo Cody, Jennifer's Body, is back with Lisa Frankenstein, a coming-of-rage horror comedy based on Mary Shelley's famous novel. 1980s goth girls, Victorian corpses, jokes about The Cure. In honor of Michigan's recent college football champions, consider the Ann Arbor Film Festival Traveling Tour, an evening of avant-garde films presented by Duke's Screen Society series. That's coming right up at February 22 at the Rubenstein Arts Center. And on February 24th, the North Carolina Museum of Art Cinema presents a documentary, Invisible Beauty, chronicling the work of pioneering black fashion model and activist Bethann Hardison. And finally, heads up, nerds, the strike-delayed sci-fi sequel Dune Part 2 is now scheduled to open on March the 1st. And this one article is a book review and an interview with Jill McCorkle, whose book Old Crimes and Other Stories was released in January of this year by Algonquin Books. And there's no time to read it all, or indeed even most of it. The title of this book, though, a short story collection called Old Crimes, hints at dramatic secrets. Some of the regrets embedded in those secrets are painful. In The Lineman, the second story in the collection, a man ruminates on his regret at cheating on his high school sweetheart, but considers the great gift of his daughter from his second rocky marriage. In the closing story, Sparrow, a town gratuitously discusses a woman's murder-suicide, only later wondering if the story isn't quite what it seems. Most of the stories are about regrets over things left undone. In the title story, a woman thinks back to a neglected child she met on a rather listless vacation with her boyfriend. In The Last Station, a woman finally expresses her regret at all the years she spent placing her family, placating, I guess, who don't even remember her birthday, above herself. She's been writing in and about the South for decades, with a few discussions discursions to the Northeast. Originally from Lumberton, the Dos Passos Prize winner has spent years teaching at several universities, including Chapel Hill, Duke, and Harvard. Now based in Hillsboro, she recently retired from teaching creative writing at NC State, but says she plans to continue taking students at workshops and touring with Old Crimes this year. And on the heels of this release, she sat down on a question and answer session, which I will have to close at this point. So John Fedderson will have to go away now, and we'll be back next week, I hope, with an Indie Week issue to present in full, as far as it can be. And it's available as a podcast, this show, after the initial broadcast Friday. North Carolina Reading Service says so long from Indie Week.